Hey everyone, this is Made for Music. I am your host, Duncan Byerjohn. The reason I started this podcast was growing up, music was my ultimate passion, but I didn't know how to get started. So this podcast seeks to depict a comprehensive view of the music world, from the artistry to the business, so you can discover the resources available to you, and most importantly, the stories behind the people making things happen. If you dig what you hear, please rate and subscribe to Made for Music on Apple Podcasts or whatever your preferred podcast medium is. I truly appreciate that extra effort, and without further ado, here is the next episode of Made for Music. Welcome to Made for Music. Today's friend of the podcast was born and raised in Tacoma, Washington, and has been a part of some huge records, including August Burns Red, Pearl Jam, and Mother Love Bones. He also mastered the Sleepover EP from former podcast guest Date Night. He's a genius mastering engineer that primarily works with analog equipment that has been either custom built or modified. He's an absolute delight to work with and is sure to bring out the best in your recordings. So without further ado, please welcome the owner of Black Belt Mastering, the first junior Olympian on the podcast, and a true black belt, Levi Seitz.
Thank you. That's quite the intro, by the way.
Oh, I mean, I'm glad you like it.
That was very flattering. You really like built it up there.
Yeah. Everybody go to blackbeltmastering.com.
Yeah, yay, yeah. Right. Podcast done.
Yeah, you can leave now. Just kidding. Well, thanks for being here. And I guess before we dive too deep into things, would you mind giving just what mastering is for folks? Because I know come 8 years ago for me, I had no clue what I was doing.
Yeah.
I would love just kind of your definition, how that plays into the grand scheme of things.
Sure. Mastering is effectively the last step in the record making process. So a record is tracked and then mixed, and then the mastering is the final stage that is getting the mixes cohesive from an equalization, possibly compression, volume standpoint for distribution on CD or vinyl or digital. And so that's kind of in a nutshell. It's just bringing consistency to the mixes so that the listener doesn't have to adjust their volume knob, or I guess in the context of like a car or like a home stereo, the equalization. I don't think of like digital devices having, built-in EQs, even though I'm sure they do, but an old home hi-fi with like a graphic EQ on it with sliders and stuff. Effectively mastering is mitigating the need to adjust that stuff.
Beforehand, we were kind of talking about your journey to mastering. Mm-hmm. How did like music play into your life growing up, and what led you, kind of into the music world? What was your foray? And then how'd you get to where you are now?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. Music was always a part of my life growing up. My dad is a guitar player. And so guitars were always around in our house. And then his brothers, my uncles, are very musical, and so are their kids. So like when we would get together as a family, everyone was always picking up instruments and kind of just playing whatever. And so that had a big impact, on me during my formative years, of just music being a central focus, in life. My mom is an artist, and she does a bunch of, she's just very, very creative, kind of like mixed media kind of art. So I like to think that the combination of, art, an eye for art from my mom, and musical interest from my dad kind of came together. And then my own kind of, interest is more mechanical. I really love mechanical things, and I was always really curious about the way things were made. Unfortunately, for my mom, like that meant taking apart like her old clock radios and stuff like that, yes. Trying to see how things worked, and 100% of the time never putting them back together. but that kind of curiosity has really helped me, out later in life, like now, because when you're the owner of a vinyl lathe, which I have owned two different ones at this point, they're very mechanical in nature. And so I'd like to think at this point I'm no longer like taking apart and not fixing, but able to troubleshoot and actually maintain and kind of be a good steward, of these antique machines that are used to make modern records. But to get back to the question, you know, music was always very central focus in my life. And so growing up in high school and playing in like high school bands, you know, symphonic bands and jazz bands, I played the saxophone.
Oh, so cool.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
I always wanted to. So I played for like 2 years, but it took a while to get there because I was on clarinet because they told me I had to be clarinet before saxophone.
Same thing.
And then they tried to hold me there, but... Oh, yeah, I love
you were too good. That's the thing. You got to really suck at clarinet, and then they're like, well, boot him up to sax.
Yeah,
and see
get him out of here.
Yeah, yeah, put him on the sax. You know, and well, the reason I kind of like hem and haw about the saxophone is like it's like as a kid, it's just like I get all starry eyed and like it's so cool. But then when I got older, I was like, well, what are the outlets for saxophone? Like that's where I was kind of like I spent all this time, like 12 years, you know, playing the saxophone, and then like. What am I gonna do
That's
with it?
Fair. Yeah.
You know, like I feel like the outlets are like bop jazz, you know, like Charlie Parker style, just you know that kind of stuff, which like I'm not a huge fan of, even though that was kind of fun to do just now.
So maybe I'll go back.
Yeah,
to it.
Yeah, that's it. Picking up the sax again, I guess to parallel while I was learning the saxophone, I was also picking up the guitar and that to me just felt like endless possibilities of like applications and, you know, playing with friends, playing in bands, just playing, but you know, alone. That was great and a great outlet for me, you know, as kind of a frustrated teenager, you know, kind of working out song ideas and working out emotions through songs and singing and chords and, you know, happiness and frustration kind of all in the same ball. And so all that kind of came down to wanting to hear myself back and purely, you know, to play with a part or just the curiosity of like, what does it sound like when I sing this and play this together? So, as a lot of people, in my generation did, we just use a boombox, like a cassette boombox, and, you know, that had a record function on it. And so that was really like my first foray into like recording, mm-hmm. At a very amateur level. And of course, you know, the abilities of the cassette player wear out quickly.
And tape is frustrating.
Cassette tapes are frustrating. They're super noisy and I mean it's not really about fidelity, of course, at that point, but yeah, I mean the mechanics of it are kind of iffy. And so then, you know, a friend of mine in I want to say it was like junior high or something like that, his parents bought him a digital 8-track. It was one of those early like Roland VS8 40s or something, GX probably, because it had guitar effects. And I just like my mind was blown, you know, we could record multiple takes and overdub and layer harmonies. And I think that was the first spark of like, okay, I love writing music and I love, you know, being in that realm, but then this technical aspect kind of combined the two things. And so I was just hooked at that point. And so from that point, like, you know, going through high school and like college, it was all a matter of like kind of leveling up from a technology standpoint. And this is all like, you know, things like Pro Tools weren't really consumer products.
Yeah.
At that
unless
point.
You had thousands of dollars to throw.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And I don't think I even used Pro Tools. I think it was version 5.3.1 was the first version I had used. I want to say that was around 2002 or 2003. Very, very early. Not super user friendly. And I think a lot of people, you know, I don't want to say I got into the recording industry like at the transition from tape to digital, but it was kind of on the back end, like where things were maybe 80% digital and 10 or maybe 15%, you know, tape. And so when I graduated from high school, I kind of waffled a little bit and didn't go to school right away. But then ended up going to the Art Institute, downtown Seattle. And so the technology they had there was that early Pro Tools 5.3.1. And they still had like half inch you know, tape machines and 2-inch tape machines. So I definitely got a little experience on analog tape and Pro Tools. And I was still writing a lot of music at that time, but I'd say like that was the beginning of the end of me wanting to pursue music, and the start of, me wanting to just go full, like all chips in on like the technical side of it.
Yeah. How did having that exposure to tape before that transition affect your process, or did it? Were you just like, never mind, we'll go the, you know, digital route for Pro Tools, because you use analog equipment now. So back then, what were you thinking about that, or was...
Well, we'll separate analog equipment in this context as like tape machines. So like the recording medium. Mm-hmm. And then I think what you're talking about maybe is like analog equipment. So like outboard EQs and compressors and processing units. I didn't have that second category back then. In fact, I wouldn't even have known what to do with an analog EQ, you know, or compressor. And I don't think, as far as compression is concerned, I wouldn't have been able to hear the difference. Like I hadn't, my ear wasn't trained yet. Mm-hmm. The early cassette stuff, kind of like I mentioned earlier, it didn't really bother me that the fidelity was really poor. It was just, I was just stoked to like hear myself back.
Yeah.
And I didn't really work more with tape machines until much later in my career. And I've never been terribly fond of operating tape machines.
Yeah.
You know, like yay digital, 'cause it's, you turn it on and it's kind of already calibrated and you can kind of hit record if you're set up. But with like tape machines, you know, there's things like bias and the head azimuth and zenith and like all these parameters that need to be set correctly, and degaussing the heads and cleaning the heads. And you know, I think people get kind of romantic about tape, and they think, you know, that in a mastering context, like, well, if I just record my music to tape and then capture the output of the tape machine, which would be like a tape layback, is kind of what that's known as, I'm going to get a sound. It's going to just be like instant Motown or, you know, something that they have this kind of rosy idea of like this era of music that only used tape. And then their music's going to sound like that if they go to tape. And quite frankly, it's not really true. Like the reason those records sound that way is because the people who were playing them played them a certain way, or, you know, those records were captured with a certain sound and feel to them.
100%.
It wasn't like the tape machine that just like instantly did this little trick that like, oh, now it sounds like Motown.
Yeah.
It certainly contributed, but it wasn't all of it. Fast forward to like now, you know, I do have tape machines if someone brings me reels of tape to master from, but, I find that for me personally, using analog equipment, I just like the tactile nature of it and kind of the ergonomics of it. I also feel more confident applying processing like EQ and compression if it's in the analog domain. It is a much more permanent thing, because you're printing the result of that EQ onto the workstation that you're capturing the masters on. And this might be a kind of a lazy explanation, but you know, if I have an analog EQ and it has, you know, balanced inputs and outputs, it's always going to work, or it's always going to do that thing, you know, as long as the capacitors don't blow up or whatever. But like with software, like, you know, you have to keep versioning like updates and version. This plugin doesn't work with this version of Pro Tools, and this version of Pro Tools doesn't work with this operating system, and like, forget all that.
Yeah.
So I like to think that I'm somewhat like software agnostic, where the software I play mixes from could be anything, as long as it has a digital output, or I can connect, you know, to a converter. And then my analog chain is, I'll say, timeless, because it will always do what I know it can do, regardless of what version of the software I have. And then, you know, capturing and sequencing a record again, like that's very like pragmatic and mechanical, and it rarely imparts a sound, you know, a euphonic sound on the record. So I love working in the analog domain. I don't really like working from tape, but in 2019, I'm seeing very few records come in on analog tape.
Yeah, I saw, I think it was just on YouTube, but like a Foo Fighters documentary, they did one of their albums fully on tape.
Sure.
And even the drummer was like, why are we doing this? Just because of all that maintenance that was going into it. And pretty much the stuff you just mentioned. And also he was messing up for
a labor of love.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the other thing that, you know, the performance has to be there. And that's, you know, there's good things and there's bad things about technology being so readily available, recording technology being readily available to people today. You know, a lot of people that maybe couldn't get into a studio 20 years ago now have access, you know, with very few amount of dollars you can buy a you know,
you don't need a $500,000 recording contract.
Exactly. And you can make demos and record things pretty well, whereas like 20 years ago, like the only reason you would be in a studio is if you had the chops to like earn that right to be there. You know, and yeah, it excluded a lot of people that were creative with music in different ways potentially. So yeah, there's good and bad things about availability of music technology.
Absolutely. And you get exposed to this in college. You've been exposed to Pro Tools now. And actually, do you master, what's your DAW that you
I have two different software suites that I use primarily. One as like a pitcher, so I'm sending songs out of a software called Studio One. I think Presonus makes that.
Yeah.
Which still is a little odd to me. I don't think of them as like a software manufacturer. I'm sure they bought that software suite from someone else and just branded it with their brand. But it works well. And the thing I like about it is that, and I know Pro Tools can do this, but I can use my iPad as basically a transport. So I load all the songs in on Studio One. And then, and I actually, there's a mastering like workflow in Studio One, and I don't use that. I tried it once, and I think it sounds, here's the exception where that particular instance of the software, whatever it's doing, I didn't like how it sounded. Uh-huh. I thought it sounded thin and congested. And so I don't use the Studio One mastering suite like it's supposed to be used. I actually use the mix window or the mix, you know, option as if you were like tracking or mixing a song. And so my iPad acts as like a transport. And so I can kind of hit play and stop and, you know, return to the beginning of the song and switch between songs, which I found really handy because I don't need to have like an additional computer in front of me. The computer that is in front of me is the computer that is capturing the result of the output of my desk. So, and that software is called Samplitude. It's made by a company called Magix.
I'm not familiar.
Yeah, they're not typically a name that you'll hear in like the recording and mixing world. Their two flagship mastering products are Samplitude and Sequoia. And they have the ability to author like a Redbook standard CD and make DDP images. Those are kind of mastering exclusive features that you just wouldn't ever need as a mix engineer or a recording engineer. So yeah, outputting from Studio One, and then that signal is converted to analog and that hits my desk. I kind of have like a routing console that allows me to kind of put different pieces of gear in and out, you know, with the push of a button. And then the output of the console goes to Samplitude where it's captured.
Right on. Very cool. Thanks for sharing that. That stuff's like super cool to me because I love going through and just like, I think anyone trying to build out their mastering suite, that's perfect. So thank you.
It's a little nerdy.
No,
a little overshare on the gear.
No, that's what this is all about. Like, no joke, I'll get texts from people. They're like, I love the tech breakdown because people are like looking for that stuff.
Yeah.
And that's like the whole reason that we're here.
Oh, it's fun.
That's perfect.
Yeah, it's fun to chat about.
Yeah. And so you were learning this stuff in college, and what does that look like? You've got your introduction to recording, and you mentioned that was kind of your pivot from, I don't think I want to pursued the my own music so much as I want to do Correct. This here. So mm-hmm. what did that look like after getting exposure to that?
That looked like dropping out of school.
Nice.
You know, effectively, I was at the Art Institute for like 2.5 quarters. And I think halfway through my third quarter of my first year, I dropped out. And there was a couple things going on. One, it was crazy expensive. Yeah. And it kind of, the writing was on the wall, or the realization that like, okay, it's costing me this much per quarter, and like, I only have this much money left, and like, it's just not going to work out. And then the other thing was, I in hindsight, realizing like the first year is very introductory, and I had been kind of recording my own stuff, going into it. And, you know, me and another, friend of mine that were in that year, we were like way going above and beyond, and like trying to book studio time before we were supposed to, and like doing extracurricular work and like taking every opportunity. And it just seemed like I still wasn't getting enough time. Which is good. That's a good problem to have, I guess.
Yeah.
Ultimately it just led to me dropping out, and, I got a job, like a normal job at a mall. Kind of didn't really know what I was going to do next. And then a friend of mine who was still going to the Art Institute was like, hey, they're doing a portfolio review for the next class that's graduating. Come up and hang out. And I was like, okay. Went up there, and on their like corkboard bulletin board was basically an ad for an internship at a studio in Portland called Jackpot. And for those of you who don't know Jackpot, it's owned by a guy named Larry Crane, who runs Tape Op magazine, and it's a wonderful studio. And Larry had started this studio with Elliot Smith. And I was a huge Elliot Smith fan. And I took the number down, and I just thought like, how great is this? Like, no one else can apply for this that's seeing it, because they're all in school.
Yeah.
And here I just dropped out, and like, so I'm totally gonna pursue it. And I did, and I went down there and met with Larry, and he was super cool. And I ended up getting an internship down there, and I had some family down in the Portland area, so I went and lived with them.
Very cool.
Yeah, I was down there for about a year. And there was kind of, you know, another odd twist there where, I was super young, and that's not the twist, twist.
Game
I was
changer,
young.
I aged.
Yeah. Right. This weird thing that keeps happening every year. You know, I didn't realize like how great of an opportunity that was. And if you're starting out, like if you're listening to this right now and you get an internship at a studio or a record label or a place that does the thing that you want to do, I'm telling you right now, like, do everything you can to stay there. Like, any opportunity that comes up, like, take it. So, you know, I was there for, I think I'd been there for like a month, and we had worked on some sessions, and I was doing the normal intern stuff, like setting up and cleaning up and grabbing food for the band and making coffee and like, you know, being as helpful as I could. But then like there was a night, and if Larry ever listens to this, I hope he gets a kick out of this. he was like, hey, we're going out to a show after the session, you know, a bunch of us are going to meet up. You want to come out? And I was like, nah. Like, I just drove home.
Yeah, you're like, I'm tired.
Yeah, I just like, oh, like the day is done. Like, why wouldn't I just go home and rest? Like, go to the show when your boss asks you, like, you know, if you want to hang out afterwards, go hang out, do whatever you can to like stay there. That's the right thing to do. Don't go home and rest. Especially if you're super young and like 22 or 23 years old, like you don't have anything better to do. I promise. Like go to the show. You know, and there was another instance like that where I think I was there on like a Friday and we're wrapping up a session, and, he was like, hey, you know, a couple of us are coming in on Saturday to like fix cables and stuff. You're welcome to come. And I was like, nah.
Yeah.
I stayed home because it was a Saturday, and like, I probably like slept in and watched cartoons or something stupid, you know, yeah. like go fix the cables. I can't impress that upon you enough. If you're listening, do the extra credit, do the extra work. Like, and it's so contradictory to like what I was saying earlier, was like I was in art school And I'm like, I want more opportunities. I want to do this more. And I drop out because I feel like I'm not getting enough. And then when I finally got there, it was just like very lackadaisical, like, okay, whatever. So, you know, kind of a confusing point in, mm-hmm. And maybe not confused as much as like, I just didn't know exactly what I wanted to do within music or within recording arts. And, you know, so as you can imagine, that internship fizzled out. Like, I think, you know, I didn't come in 1 week and then Larry had called me and, you know, and I didn't answer. I was doing something else. And then it just, you kind of lose connection. And then, you know, at some point you're just like, well, I'm just not interning there anymore, you know? Uh-huh. And so I hung out in Portland for a while longer and I actually kind of turned back toward more like musician side, writing more music. My cousin, who I was living with is a concert cellist. Oh. And yeah, wow. he's incredible. And his wife, is a concert pianist. And so they went to a music conservatory in Texas. Like, they're incredible. So I was spoiled with incredible, you know, musicians around me. So I wrote a lot of songs, played coffee house gigs, and that was super fun, but it wasn't like, I also wasn't like super ambitious about it. It was more of just kind of like a something for fun. And like almost for my own entertainment. And so, you know, it wasn't really until almost a year of being down there where I was like, I need to find a job. And I had like part-time jobs, but I want to find something more career oriented dealing with audio. And so I ended up getting a live sound gig at a church. It was back up in Tacoma. And I did like front of house at a church for like all the way through college. So when I moved back to Tacoma, I ended up going to the UW, Tacoma campus, and, finished my undergrad, kind of like an art centric degree. And worked live sound the entire time.
Cool. So what did it look like after that? You've done this live sound now? Cause that's, I mean, these are all different animals, right? Studio yeah. recording, live sound, very important, but very different
yeah.
practices. How did you then move towards the actual mastering side? Like, what introduced you to that? And were you aware of what that was at this time? I know you were in school for it, so you probably, I'm assuming, knew, but...
Yeah, I mean, I didn't get a good sense of what mastering was from school because I dropped out before that class.
Right.
I should have stuck around. I knew mastering existed, but I had no clue what it was. So after graduating from college, I moved up to Seattle, and my path to mastering was still not clear. Mm-hmm. You know, so I'd kind of done the studio thing. I'd done live sound. I moved up to Seattle and I had a guy that I went to school at the Art Institute with who had graduated from that program. He was like, hey, I got a job at Microsoft as a contractor setting up, you know, PA systems, doing like general AV kind of stuff. And he's like, you should move up here and I'll help get you a job. And he did. And very shortly after getting a job there, I realized that Microsoft has like a full blown, like post-production, like it's like a TV station, you know, audio post house, you know, they do audio editing, film editing, all for like internal videos. And I was like, that's where I want to be. That's what I'm trying next. And so, you know, while I was working at, you know, this AV job, like on my lunch breaks, I would go to this building and kind of try to hang out. And I think I did that for like 3 or 4 months and kind of got to know some of the people there. And finally, one of the guys is like, listen, there's another group in the building that do video encoding and they're hiring people left and right. So I'll help you. I'll introduce you to that, their manager, and see if I can get you a job. And he did. I got a job doing video encoding. And, I think it was 3 months I did that video encoding job. And then I'd still go hang out at like the audio rooms. Cause they had like some of the world's largest Pro Tools rigs.
Oh, wow.
You know, at the studios there. And, you know, and then after 3 months of like talking to those guys more and more and kind of having some rapport and like, you know, I had Pro Tools chops and I had some experience editing, they're like, okay, well, we're losing a guy who does our dialogue editing for this specific program. Are you interested? And I think he was like, we'll give you like a $10 an hour raise or something.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah. And I was, you know, yeah, I had just gotten married and like, you know, you're just like, how do I say no? And I didn't say no, I said yes. And so that was my first like professional audio engineering job, was editing dialogue for this program was like internal sales, and uh-huh. it was super, super non-artistic and, you know, like I'll say boring. But I loved it. I loved it because I was working in Pro Tools and I was editing and you know, it was great. And then occasionally I would do like live stage sound. So like I had to do sound for Bill Gates once, plenty of times for like Steve Ballmer when he was there. And, you know, it's kind of fun. And eventually like, you know, doing more and more audio gigs there, I started doing some sound design and post-production. So like editing, you know, basically like mixing sounds for like a 30 second, you know, digital graphic, motion graphic, something like that. And so that was probably about the time I decided I'm going to start my own, you know, audio post, like sound design company.
Uh-huh.
And I did, and I mixed sound for, I think like two feature length documentaries.
Oh,
and
very cool.
Yeah. Yeah. One's like an Australian football documentary, and then one's this, a documentary, you know, about a gentleman who does some work in Africa and with some organizations there. And it's super fun, but like Seattle, or at least the people I was connected with in Seattle, like there wasn't enough of that work to sustain like a business.
Right.
And I was also doing that stuff at Microsoft too, you know, for their internal stuff. And I kind of realized through doing it that it wasn't really my cup of tea. And so a couple things happened. Having been involved with a video compression group, one of my buddies there had introduced me to this guy named Mark Gunther. Mark was a mastering engineer and had owned Seattle Disc Mastering and been running that business for something like 12 or 15 years. And so I had met Mark, and you know, he's like, hey, this is an audio guy. Levi's an audio guy. He does post-production sound. And it was really cool to meet him. And that kind of just like sparked a little thing in my head. The other thing that was happening at that same time was that the economy was kind of starting to go down. Mm-hmm. And so when I started out at the studios there, I think it was running like 50 hours a week or something like that. And it was awesome. And my wife also worked in the building. She was doing media archive work. And so like we were both working a lot and staying busy. And then the recession kind of started happening, and like, you know, go down to like 40 hours a week, and then 30, and then 20, and then like, don't come in next week. And so I'm thinking like, okay, I don't have as much stability in my job as I thought I did. I need to come up with something else, which is kind of right around the time when I tried to start my own post-production company, which maybe lasted like 8 months, almost a year. Enter Mark Gunther, Seattle Disc Mastering. That buddy had introduced us. And, you know, so I just started emailing him, and I was like, hey, would you mind if I just came and hung out? And, in hindsight, if someone had done that with me, I probably would have ignored them.
you know, leave me alone and let me work.
Exactly. Like, who wants a pesky kid like looking over their shoulder? But Mark's a super kind and super generous person. He's very zen and just a really sweet guy. And what I didn't know is that he was thinking about,
thank you.
What I didn't know is that he was thinking about retiring soon. And so, you know, finally he was like, yeah, come on over and hang out, and went over to his studio, which was in Shoreline. And, I don't think I was there for like 2 or 3 hours. We were just talking music and shooting the breeze. And like halfway through, he's like, you know, I might think about kind of retiring soon and kind of passing the baton to someone. And then that was it. You know, we just kind of kept talking about music and how we like things to sound and stuff like that. And we didn't really like unfold that sentiment at all. And later, like, went home and talked to my wife, and she was asking me how it went, and I was like, yeah, it was really cool. Like, the gear's all cool. And at one point it was kind of weird. Like, he mentioned, like, maybe wanting to kind of pass the baton, and she's like, he was asking you if you want to, like, you know, did you not, you know, understand that? And I was like, what, really? And so I emailed him the next day, and I was like, so when you were talking about, you know, all that stuff, and he's like, were you kind of asking me? And, you know, he wrote back. He was like, yeah.
That's exactly what I was thinking.
Yeah. So that, you know, I had kind of at that point, I didn't really know what mastering really was. And so, I had kind of started my own company, Black Belt Audio Incorporated, or Black Belt Mastering. And so Mark and I kind of came up with this agreement where we had merged together. And, so I didn't take on like the Seattle Disc Mastering name, but we effectively wrote up a contract where, like, I was purchasing effectively all the equipment in his studio, and I had access to all of his sessions because we were then now going to work out of the same space. And so for that next year, I worked, you know, like hand in hand or like close with Mark, and just observed him, and then, you know, slowly kind of started taking over the sessions, and he would introduce me to his clients. You know, you can't really, like, I guess in this context, you can't sell a client list. I don't know, maybe someone out there says you can. People are welcome to go wherever they want. Mm-hmm. And so just kind of that, like, that introduction was really important. And I was just on my own time, like, trying to work with personal clients and, you know, offering cheap, you know, or free mastering. And, you know, this was all like around 2008, 2009. And so Black Belt officially became a business in 2009. So technically, you know, 2019 is my 10-year
wow,
mark.
Congrats.
Yeah. Thank you. I mean, I think I probably mastered like 2 records that first year. So like maybe 2010 is like my first official, like, year as far as like mastering multiple records. But, that was really it, like meeting Mark Gunther and, you know, by his kindness, kind of like bringing me into this business. And, you know, out of all the kind of like hobbies, or like I had mentioned earlier, like when I was writing music and living in Oregon, it was like, it was fun, but like, it was just a hobby, or like, it was something, that I didn't take terribly seriously. And, you know, throughout my life, there have been different things where, like, I'll get into this fascinating thing or something I find fascinating, and then it'll run its course in like 6 months or a year. And so, you know, with mastering, I was curious to see where it would go, and to see what my interest would be like. You know, and it was one of these things where, like, after a year and then 2 years goes by, 3, 4, you know, and I'm like still doing it and people are coming back, you start getting repeat clients. And like, that's been the coolest thing, when, you know, that first time when I had worked on a record and then they come back like 6 months later, like, we loved what you did, like, now master these tracks for us. Like that's satisfying, because ultimately I love like helping people, you know, get the most out of their record and completing a record. So, you know, clients like, there's people I've worked with, like Rocky Vadelato, you know, I've worked on multiple projects with, and like, just to have, you know, if I open my inbox and I see his name, it's just like, yes, that's a great day. Like,
yeah,
you know, or like Jeremy Enoch is someone that I've worked on a good handful of records with. And like, and that goes way further, because I've been a big fan of his music, you know, since I was in, you know, junior high. So, you know, being able to, you know, work with someone like that multiple times, but then, you know, you start to develop friendships with these people. And that's just awesome. And then you find out they're some of the kindest and nicest people you've ever met. And so it just makes it even more fun.
Totally. And you kind of talked about the transition and how Black Belt Mastering really started to take off. What was it like building what would be described on paper as a small business? You know, you've got the equipment now, you've got some clientele.
Mm-hmm.
how does it make it past that first year? You're now into, you know, year 10. What does that look like? And what's your advice to someone starting a small business within music? Because this isn't like you put in a, you know, a commercial up on TV and all of a sudden you can drive leads kind of thing.
Right, right. You know, I would say definitely proceed with caution. Like, you know, be wise about where you're spending your money. I had the ability to set up a mastering room, basically in what was a attached garage. And so, I didn't have overhead as far as rent for a studio space. You know, we were paying rent in the house that we were in, but I wasn't renting a commercial space. So that was incredibly helpful. Putting together a business plan and sticking to it is really helpful. So I think my first, you know, amount of money that I borrowed from our bank account was like $5,000. And I wrote out a plan of like, here's the equipment I need to get the job done. And I was very conservative about it. Because I didn't know if I was going to be doing it a year down the road. And so you can kind of have an graduated, business plan as far as like equipment and stuff like that later. But like when getting started out, like, you know, it might not make sense to buy like a bunch of outboard gear because you might not need it a year from from then, because you might not be working. So definitely like start small. And I think the third thing that really helped was you have to give up time, but don't devalue your time. So,
huge, yeah.
Yeah. And what I mean by that is like, I still had a full-time job. And I maintained a full-time job while I was mastering records. So I was mastering records in my spare time or in evenings. And I would work, let's say, like 9 to 4 or something like that. And then I would start a mastering session at 6 p.m. And I also had a lot of support from my wife. I mean, like a lot of support from my wife, because she would let me work all day and then come home, eat dinner, and then go out and do a 2-3 hour session. And she was cool with that. And, you know, in the first couple of years, it's not like I'm doing sessions every night. So maybe it was only once or twice a week. And, you know, we didn't have kids at the time. So it was okay for me to spend the time doing that. But she was incredibly supportive. Her family was incredibly supportive. My family. So lean on that support, but be wise, you know, with your time. And I think this comes in later, but maybe knowing when to say no, you know, it definitely is great to have ambition and try things that you're uncomfortable with, but like, definitely if you don't feel like you can, effectively complete a service, I would not take on that job. Definitely take on something that you're confident that you can complete.
For sure. That's awesome. Appreciate you sharing that as well. And with that business, and as you know, business starting to grow, you mentioned, you know, knowing what projects to take on, but then also making sure that you can be successful.
Yeah.
On that flip side, what should artists be doing to ensure the project is successful, to enable you to do your job? And then on the flip, like, what are you looking for when someone comes to you?
Yeah. You know, I think working with someone, I mean, this is tricky, because you want to work with someone that has experience, and so you know what you're getting into. So Duncan, you and I had talked previously about your experience looking for mastering and how you had kind of vetted various mastering engineers, looking at their credits and, you know, finding like bands that have a similar sound to what you're trying to achieve and people that have worked with those bands. That's great. You know, we'll see these threads on Facebook where someone says, who should I use for mastering? And, you know, the same 6 people get mentioned, and that's cool and everything. But my answer to those questions, even if my name is listed, is look at your top 5 favorite records or top 10 favorite records. You know, all that information of who worked on those records is available on Discogs or AllMusic. And it's very possible that you'll find a common thread of like, you know, 6 of those 10 records were mastered by this person. And I can guarantee you that person wants to master your record, or they have a website and they'll, you know, you can hire them. And so, you know, it's a little maybe counterintuitive to like me trying to get local business saying like, just look at your favorite records and hire that person. But on the other side, it's like people should work with someone that they're excited about working with, and you know, someone that they kind of know going into it, they're going to get a result that is paralleled with what their expectation is. But I would just say being organized and, you know, working with people that can, you can see are organized. Like if someone has a website and it's laid out funky or it doesn't make sense, like you can kind of imagine that that mastering process is going to go the same way.
Yes.
you know, or if like someone just seems like unbelievably cheap, you know, and they don't have any pictures of equipment or records they've worked on and they're charging $10 a song. It's like, you can kind of imagine that's going to sound not great.
Like sound like a $10 master.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, and on the flip side, it's like, okay, well, if you're just getting started, like how do you get started without credits? And I think it's simply trying to leverage your immediate community and people that you're close to. You know, when I got started, I wasn't getting an email from Pearl Jam saying like, hey, master, you know, or cut our vinyl, because that would have been absurd. Like I had a close friend who was a mix engineer and I said to him, you know, the next record that you mix, even though it's going to someone else for mastering, like, would you send it to me and let me master it? And then I'll send it back to you and you can give me feedback. And we did that on like a handful of records until he was like, okay, this is actually like something I could be happy, you know, about with my client and, you know, how the record would end up. So, I would say leverage, you know, your close community if you don't have any experience. And then over time, you know, you can kind of slowly put on like, you know, I've worked with this person, or if you find that there's a genre that excites you more, you can kind of cater to that community or go see shows, you know, those bands and get a business card and hand it out. And like, it might feel a little awkward, but, I've definitely had awkward instances with bands that I have adored. And then, you know, 10 or 8 years later, end up working with them because they've come to me,
yep.
You know, so like put yourself out there. It can be difficult, to kind of break out of your shell a little bit, but definitely like pursue it.
Totally. And then for artists as well, like I mentioned, when I was getting started, didn't know what mastering was or how to deliver something properly. I think I told you, I just sent a mastering engineer stems and he was like, dude,
what do I do?
So what should an artist, let's say they've got their record mixed, or I guess that should be a step. I should take a step back. What should artists be doing before they come to you or a mastering engineer? Like what sets up the mastering process for success?
Yeah. Having a good sense of your song order is really important. I would say like 98% of the time I will start with the first song in the record. Like that's the song I start mastering. And if your band has a sound that is consistent and cohesive throughout the record, then that can kind of set the foundation for the way the entire mastering will sound and how I approach each song in mastering. The first song is kind of setting that bar. And so when I'm working on song 2 or 5 or 6 or whatever, I'm always going back and referencing that first master that I've done so that the degree of change from song 2, 3, 4, 5 is as minuscule as possible. If I was always referencing the previous mix or the previous song, the tendency is that the record kind of gets louder and brighter as it goes on. So figuring out kind of what your flagship song is, or a song that kind of encapsulates the feel and sound for the rest of the record, that can be really helpful. You know, the times when I kind of like roll my eyes and get a little frustrated is like if someone sends me a folder with additional things that I don't need, which would be like alternate mixes that they actually don't want to use. Yeah. See, you just rolled your eyes.
Yeah.
Or like isolated tracks, or, you know, like let's say they add all like the instrumental tracks, but they're not having instrumentals mastered, just like extra stuff like that I don't need. Cause like for efficiency's sake, like the best scenario is like I get a Dropbox link or, you know, we transfer something like that, and it's a folder with the songs labeled 1 through 10 with the names. And that's, I guess that's another thing. You know, when you're labeling, and it's just file management at this point, you're just labeling that file with the name of the song. Like, that's super helpful for me. Cause then I know that's song one and it's called I Love You, and song two is called I Hate You, and you know, and record's over.
It's a A side, B side.
Yeah. Yeah. 45 inch. Seven inch. Yeah.
Yeah, 7 inch.
Very bipolar. Mixed reviews. That's helpful. Cause then when I deliver you masters, you know, I can label the final song with the correct name. And so that kind of information is really helpful. You know, I would say 8 years ago, CDs were king, and I was making physical CD masters for almost every session. I have maybe made two in the last 3 years. But like ISRC codes were something mm-hmm. that people had a lot. And so like having that information, it's not something I deal with vinyl. With vinyl mastering, I'll say the thing that would be super helpful if everyone did is have what's called a matrix or a catalog number when they contact me. And that is simply a series of numbers and letters that you make up or your record label provides to you. So like Rocket Heart Records is a label in town that I've cut for. And so it's like RHR-008. Great. So that gets physically etched onto the lacquer so that the plant can not lose that part and keep track of it and marry it with the correct label and packaging and sleeve and all that stuff. So, coming up with a matrix number. The other thing with vinyl mastering, you know, which would be me cutting lacquers, it's a little bit backwards. So whether, you know, if I'm doing the digital mastering and those are approved and a band is ready to move on to vinyl, the band actually has to initiate an order with a pressing plant before I can cut.
Oh, I did not know that.
Yeah. Lacquers have like a really short shelf life. They need to be going through the manufacturing process to get plated like within 24 hours of being cut. It's very short, like 24, 48. You want it done within a day,
right?
Or two.
How does that actually work? I'm not familiar with when you're saying plated. Is that the actual pressing of
records? Yeah. So I'm happy to walk through that, that step process. So with vinyl mastering and to be clear, you know, vinyl mastering is the process of cutting a lacquer master, that physical disc that goes on to be produced to be a vinyl record. A lot of studios will say like, we master for vinyl, and they're just giving you digital files for the A side and the B side. Like, that's part of it, but that's not actually vinyl mastering, because when you're cutting the lacquer, you really don't know what kind of equalization or level that you need until you're looking at those grooves through a microscope. And so like that's when the mastering part comes in, and like optimizing it for vinyl and through a cutting lathe. And so so once your digital mastering is approved, that A and B side digital file, or in some cases tape, which is again super rare, but that goes to a cutting engineer. So I happen to have a vinyl lathe that was made in Germany like in the 1950s.
Oh, so cool.
Yeah. And the crazy thing is like those machines are the most relevant machines to do this process. Like, they stopped making vinyl lathes like in the early 1980s. In fact, 1982, I believe, was the very last production year for what's called a VMS 82 lathe. And so all the machines are, you know, I was born in 82, so newest lathe is 37 years old.
Why do you think it's like, why do you think it's coming back?
I think people want something tangible. Mm-hmm. I think there's an experience there, that people don't get when they have 10,000 songs on their phone. And for me personally, if I spend $10 or $20 on a record, I want to own it. I want to hold it. And I'm itching for an opportunity to like take a break and sit back and soak in a record. So I think that is part of it.
Totally.
But to get back to the manufacturing process, so that physical lacquer. So lacquer is basically like an aluminum plate that is curtain coated in nitrocellulose lacquer. And we all know what that is because old Fender guitars used to be coated in nitrocellulose lacquer, a nitro finish. Lacquer is also the same exact compound that like fingernail polish is made out of. So these aluminum discs are coated in lacquer and then they're cured and they're put on a lathe, which looks like a turntable on steroids. And instead of a tone arm with a stylus to play back your record, they have what's called a cutter head. And that cutter head has a little ruby cutting tool in it, a ruby stylus. And that stylus is connected to what's called a torque tube that is connected to like a very small left and right side driver, like a little speaker. And so think of it like a little miniature pair of headphones. If you put headphones on your ear, on your head, and your ears are on the receiving end, your eardrum vibrates back and forth and creates a mechanical, electromechanical signal that your brain translates to music. That stylus is connected to a rod that's connected to those little speakers that basically translates that vibration to a pattern, a mechanical pattern in the lacquer as the disc is spinning. And that's all it is. Like, it's just, it's all mechanics. It's really awesome. And so once a lacquer is cut, they're 14 inches in diameter. They're a lot larger than an actual record. That 14 inch lacquer gets shipped to what's called an electroforming plant. And the lacquer is dunked in like a aqueous metal solution that's part nickel. And there's all sorts of other metals in there, but it has a current, like a DC current that runs through it. And effectively what happens is that nickel adheres to the surface of the lacquer. It's also sprayed with nickel, I believe, before it goes in. I'm not totally clear on the exact process of the electroforming plant, but it's sprayed with nickel and it goes in the tank, the nickel bath. And then effectively a metal part is formed on the surface of the lacquer, and it fully realizes and fills in the grooves. And so that plate is then peeled back off the lacquer. And then in some cases, that initial convert, that plate that's converted from the lacquer, is then crimped and coined in a machine and used as a stamper. That would be like a one-step process. You can actually get up to three steps if you're making like a backup copy. So they'll actually plate a plate and then make a copy off of that. And so you get these positive and negatives. So the stamper is a negative of the lacquer, and that plate, that stamper, goes into a hydraulic press. And the press has these large circular dies that are heated, I think, to like 250 degrees. And there's the A side and the B side on top and the bottom. And they put what looks exactly like a little hockey puck of melted PVC in between the plates, and they just smash down, you know, with the labels. Yeah, that's the pressing. And so, like, you have the lacquer, which is, you know, the first step, and then a stamper, and the stamper presses out a record. So what I make, and what sometimes people get confused about, they're like, how many records can you press or can you cut for me? And I'm like, one. I can cut the master mold. Mm-hmm. And that goes on and gets pressed into like 100, or, you know, I think some of the Pearl Jam stuff I've cut, the metric I heard was like 50,000 copies.
Wow.
You know, are getting pressed of one of them. And so, you know, the pressure's on at that point, you know, because it's not like a digital thing where they can just pull down a Bandcamp link and like, oh, there was a glitch or a mistake, and then we put up a fixed one. It's like, no, 50,000 copies of this are getting pressed. And you think about those steps where it's very crude, you know, where it's in a bath and this nickel is adhering to it, and like all the different potential like sediments that can, you know, create noise or pops or clicks on a record. So, you know, we're talking about a process that really hasn't changed since the 1950s, yet our minds are conditioned to 2019 of thinking, you know, of how the recording process works. So it's pretty common for, you know, I'll cut an acetate, which is like a reference lacquer that people can play at home. That's on a 12-inch disc. You know, and they're like, well, it sounds quieter than my digital masters, or maybe there's not as much high end. And like a lot of these things that when given the opportunity to do an A-B comparison, you're realizing that vinyl has certain defects, you know, which are also part of why people loved it. You know, like,
yeah,
vinyl sounds warm and it sounds tight and punchy. Well, that's because like the high end, you know, let's say above like 13 kilohertz, like just doesn't translate to that physical medium exactly like it does with the digital. And like below 60 hertz, like those low frequencies don't translate the way they do in digital. So like you end up getting a more compact and like a tighter version of your masters on vinyl, but a lot of times it sounds better because you just don't have this extra like super and like sub frequency information.
You're
just kind
of cutting the fat on either side. Yeah,
exactly. You're trimming the fat off, and like, and I always love it when the opposite reaction, where someone hears the vinyl and they're like, oh yes, this is how I imagined it should sound, you know, because they have that like context, you know, and that sound in their mind, and I love it, you know. I think it can sound rich, and it can sound very full. But it's definitely like if you were to stack up like a digital, you know, 24-bit master versus a vinyl master, like there's going to be more noise in the vinyl. Like it's physically a needle scratching the surface of PVC, you know, yeah, as it spins around. Like you're going to get noise, like you're going to hear the dust that's in there. And that's kind of part of the charm of it.
Totally. That's super cool. I at some point want to do a vinyl to get the right record to do it, but now I'm just like ready to do it now.
Let's do it. I know a guy.
Yeah. I guess on that note, is there anything you want to add, and then how can people find you?
Yeah. You can go to my website, blackbeltmastering.com. You know, I'm on Facebook and Instagram. But
you
can
see all this cool equipment.
Yeah, I've just got some new equipment too. A new EQ all the way from Taiwan.
Nice. I saw that. How quick did they get here? I saw you mentioned you were like getting it quickly from Taiwan.
It was
to
shipped
Seattle.
On Monday.
What?
Yeah.
No way.
Or like Tuesday.
Wow.
So yeah, big shout out to Richard at Mobeneco. Mobeneco is a vinyl pressing plant in Taiwan that I cut a lot of lacquers for. And the guy who was selling this EQ is like a couple hours away from the Mobeneco plant. And so I was like, oh, I've got a contact there. And so he shipped it there, and then Richard shipped it to me. So big thanks to him. You know, which I guess brings up an interesting point is, you know, vinyl is it's a global economy in the sense that with how accessible information is, and you can go online and find these plants, you know, they might be based in Taiwan, but they have super, you know, fast shipping to the US, or there might be another plant I cut for is a plant called Furnace, and they're in Virginia, and they do a fantastic job. You know, all these places, you know, they're the right solution for the right band and the right record. And you know, I love working for these plants that they really want to get the best possible sound, and they've put a lot of time and money into, you know, like Furnace and Mobeneco both have new presses that were made recently, and so, you know, they're investing in this in the long term. And you know, I think vinyl is going to be around. It's been around forever, and it's going to be around forever. And so that's, you know, something that excites me about like continually learning more about this process and offering that service here locally. You know, I think the main thing is for people is just don't hesitate to reach out, you know, whether it's an email or contacting me online. Like, you know, the reason I have this studio and this lathe, like it's to serve the community, and it's to help people make music and make records. So, yeah, just look forward to working with new people all the time.
Right on. And thank you so much for doing this. This is awesome.
My pleasure.
I really appreciate it. And for sure, I know you've got a lot of cool projects coming up. We'll be sure to share some of those as they roll out.
Cool.
So thank you again so much. This is awesome.
Thanks, Duncan.
Cheers. That was the title track to Jeremy Enoch's solo album, Return of the Frog Queen, which Levi remastered for digital and vinyl last year. So go ahead and check that out. And be sure to visit blackbeltmastering.com if you want to hire Levi or check out some of his services. And if you dig what you hear, please be sure to rate and subscribe to Made for Music on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or whatever your preferred podcast medium is. Truly appreciate that extra effort, and I will see you next time.